Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the United States Institute of Peace, and thank you for arriving despite the bad weather. Regrettably, our speaker from the Department of Defense had to cancel his appearance today due to official duties, but I think that with the people we have on the panel, you will still find this an enlightening presentation and a discussion opportunity. Just as a reminder, I would ask that everybody silence their cell phones so as to not disrupt the train of thought of others. I think everybody has the biographies of our speaker, so I won't waste time trying to go over that with you, but they should be well known to the community. Barbara Stevenson from the Department of State, Lieutenant Colonel Linda Granfield, a former PRT commander in Afghanistan, and our own Bob Perito from the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I am Paul Hughes, the ROC Senior Program Officer here at USIP. I will give the speakers 15 minutes each to make their presentations, their remarks, after which we will then enter into a general question and answer period with you providing the questions. There are two microphones on either side of the room, and I would ask that when the Q&A session begins, that you line up at the microphone for your questions. Today's topic is provincial reconstruction teams in Iraq, and it's a very hot and timely topic with regards to the president's new strategy forward in Iraq. There are a lot of questions that can be generated quickly by just the mere thought of a PRT that has existed in Iraq or in Afghanistan for the last few years, as opposed to what the president is proposing for these new PRTs that will go in as part of the new security operation in Baghdad. Will they have different roles and responsibilities? Will they respond to different authorities? Do they have different missions than the ones that already exist in Iraq? How are they going to be resourced? How are they going to be staffed? These, among many other issues, are the kinds of topics that we hope to put out on the floor for discussion today. And without further ado, I will turn to our first speaker, who I will ask to be Barbara Stevenson, and then we will have Linda and then Bob. So please, welcome Barbara Stevenson from State.
It's a pleasure to see all of you. Do you want me to speak from the podium?
Yeah, okay. That'd be fine.
I have my...
I've gotten to do this presentation this morning with the House Republican leadership and yesterday with HACFO staff, so I think I can hit most of these topics right off the bat on the operational concept. What are we trying to do with the PRTs? We've kept two of the missions that you'll have been familiar with from the earlier iterations of PRTs, which is fostering economic development and building capacity at the provincial and local levels. Those still stay on the list of what's the mission of these PRTs. But we're adding missions to it. And it's the missions are bolstering moderates, which I think we might have some lively discussion about here today, promoting reconciliation, and then supporting counterinsurgency efforts. So those are the three new missions that have gotten added into this. And we are placing this PRT increase inside of also the overarching strategy that has to do with decentralizing the USG's approach in Iraq. I mean, we are very green zone centric now. And there's a conscious effort to actually to reach out to have, as the Secretary calls it, more points of opportunity for success. This is a recognition that the U.S. has got wide-ranging interests in Iraq, and if we are going to be able to shape outcomes and have access and influence, we need to be in more places than just the green zone. So overarching idea of decentralized approach, hastening a transition to Iraqi self-reliance, that part has stayed there, but then we are enumerating it in that with the five that I mentioned. The how, the nuts and bolts of it, it's an increase of, we have 10 PRTs now, and so we're adding 10. And the 10 that we're adding, let me do the 10 that exist just to be sure everybody's on the same page on this. We've got two that are paired with divisions, Baghdad Division and Anbar Division, so that's two. Then we have four PRTs that are paired with brigades, they're on FOBs, Nineveh, Kirkuk, Saladin, and Diyala. Then we have four others that are actually not paired with the U.S. military, and these have separate support arrangements. These are the three that are coalition-led, so that's Airbil, which is Korean-led, DCAR, which is Italian-led, but on a U.S. airbase, and then BASRA, which is, of course, U.K.-led and now on a U.K. airbase. And then the fourth one in that category is Babel, which is where we have a regional embassy office. And so for those four, we're not co-located with the military. They have a State Department support platform for security as well as for all the office stuff. So six are right now paired with the military, four are not. The 10 that we are adding, we're using the term embedded, the 10 new embedded PRTs. And these are to be embedded with the brigade combat teams, six into Baghdad, three into Anbar, and one into North Babel, which is an area south of Baghdad that our presence of team on the ground believes is really important. So we're going from 10 to 20, and all the new ones will be these embedded PRTs. We're doing it in phases. It's intended to complement the military surge. So phase one of this actually takes 40 people out first. The 10 new PRTs, each one will have a core team of four. A senior State Department officer to serve as a team leader, a seasoned direct hire AID officer to serve as a development advisor, a DOD civil affairs person, and then we've asked for a bilingual bicultural advisor to be provided by DOD. That will happen eventually, either they will or we will, but to have somebody who's an Arabic speaker on the team. So 10 teams of four. We are going to train them together before they go out in a brand new initiative that the Foreign Service Institute has agreed to undertake. We've worked with our interagency partners to develop the curriculum, and that course is going to kick off on March 12. So we will have trained them in each other's planning cultures, each other's cultures. Thinking about conflict, how do you assess it? How do you shape conflict dynamics, as well as nuts and bolts of where does money come from, and you know, how do you spend it, and what are the restrictions? So we're hoping that people go out primed to plug right in at the commander level and do a joint assessment of what's driving conflict in their area of responsibility, and then develop a truly joint CIVMIL strategic plan for changing the conflict dynamics in that area. And we want always to be thinking about how do you make this environment more hospitable for moderates, that is, people who are prepared to pursue their goals peacefully, politically, and within the rule of law, and how do you make it a place where violent extremists just don't feel comfortable operating. And we want to actually bring the SERP money and the foreign assistance money, harness it to a same plan that is trying to work towards shifting those conflict dynamics. So our metrics will be less about baseball fields built, buildings built, about reconstruction qua reconstruction, than it will be about trying to shape a political outcome that creates room for moderates to flourish. That's phase one. They'll go out and do the strategic plan. Phase two is to have a lot of the specialists that have been, and this is not quite so true, so let me save that comment. The specialists actually go out to fill in then the position. So these are things like engineers and city planners and agribusiness and industry specialists to fit plug into that core management team. Most of those will go into the 10 new PRTs to fill out the teams, but there will also be some plussing up of Diyala and Saladin, which are restive and need reinforcements. Phase three is just a plussing up of specialists in Babel, Basra, Dikar, Kirkuk, Nineveh, and Erbil, although I think Erbil may not plus up, so let me just hold that one in brackets. These requirements were actually developed by PRT leaders in the field. We went out and said, given Iraqi capacity to absorb, what do you need on your team to actually give you the tools to hasten this transition to Iraqi self-reliance? So we're working back off of, we have 10 categories that they came up with, numbers that they need, and very specific job descriptions that the PRT leaders are writing. The total surge requirement is 322. Phase one is the 40, the four core teams for 10 embedded PRTs. Phase two is 140, and phase three is 142. Given the restrictions on, we turned to DOD for phase two, and they have agreed to do so. They will make 109 specialists available in addition to the 20 members, right, the 2 times 10 from phase 1, 109 military specialists. And DOD, we have requested that they make them available for phase 2, and DOD has agreed to do so, drawing off of a variety of sources. They're looking at their DOD civilian population, active duty where the skill set might be, already mobilized reservists and guards, and then where there's not any other recourse, they'll go to contracting as well, with the requirement that the State Department backfill. And then phase 3 with 142 is completely belongs to state and aid to fill it. We have done missions. We've done how to staff. I might do command and control, because I suspect, is that an issue that you guys care about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I thought it might be. We've come up with these guiding principles. The guiding principles are that the brigade combat team and the PRT are one team, that together they will receive guidance from both the ambassador and the commanding general. They will both follow a common plan for the area of responsibility. There is a real emphasis in this new way forward on trying to achieve greater cohesion, greater unity of effort and purpose between the civilian and the military side. We are still in negotiations with our colleagues from DOD. That is why Alan von Egmont is not with us today, because we're trying to finalize a memorandum of agreement, which actually captures all of these things. But where we are going to come out, I'm pretty sure, is that the chief of mission, the ambassador, will provide political and economic policy guidance to all PRTs. Then we have paired PRTs, which are these existing PRTs that are on the six paired, the six ones that are paired. They will take their guidance and direction from the chief of mission, and they'll coordinate with the local commander at the forward operating base. The embedded PRTs will also, again, receive their political and economic policy guidance from the chief of mission. But given the environment we're going into, these people will be embedded in brigade combat teams that will be involved in kinetic operations, clearing and holding. We have decided that they will be placed under what DOD would call tactical control of the brigade combat, the brigade commander, the combat team leader. That means the brigade combat leader actually does have the authority to decide whether it is safe enough for the PRT to go out. In practice, we have this already on the paired PRTs, because if it's too dangerous to go out for the military movement teams, the PRT does not move. The same thing applies on the 4 that are State Department run. If the contracted security in the intelligence view is that it is too dangerous to go out, the PRT does not move. But there's still a sense here, and we have recruited our PRT leaders making this clear, you will be very tightly embedded, and there will be tactical control of the brigade combat team, particularly over security and movement. That it's supposed to be held there, but this has been a topic of... You can hear how many footnotes there are to that. It wasn't like there was a one-size-fits-all solution. This took a lot of negotiating. On funding, we are asking for, in the FY07 supplemental, which the President presented on February 5, the Secretary has been up, will be up again on Friday. All of us have been up all the time asking for this. It's $1.2 billion in additional resources. And we use a term, it's not to be necessarily contracted directly by the PRTs, but they will be guided by, spent in the provinces under the direction of PRTs. So some of these are centrally administered programs. Those of you from an aid background will be familiar perhaps with the highly regarded community stabilization program. We're asking for $384 million additional in that one. That is a job, it's got a proven track record of doing job creation and graduating people on to higher training as they go. That one is centrally administered, but it's run by AID in the center, but the PRTs will have a shaping role. And community action program also, we're looking at $50 million there. PRDCs, which is the Provincial Reconstruction Development Team Corps or Councils, there's $720 million going into this. We sometimes present this as civilian SERP. It is fairly flexible money from a civilian point of view, and it is fairly quick, allows you to do quick impact projects, and so that we ask for a significant plussing up. And then we asked for $414 million for operations budget because under the memorandum of agreement, we have agreed that DOD, where it provides security at 16 of the 20 PRTs, they will provide it, DOD will provide it, state will not reimburse. On the whole question of life support and operations and maintenance, what we have worked out is that on the 16 where we are co-located, DOD will actually provide the service. So whether that's the KBR contract or the bottled water or laundry service or fuel, we will be able to take advantage of DOD supply lines, but state will have the obligation to reimburse DOD for all the PRT activities. So that's what we're looking to come to closure on. There's no disagreement in the principle. There's just hit some spanners in the works about, like, in-theater mil-air, which can be a budget buster if you start reimbursing on that. So those are some of the last bits we're trying to work out. Let me close with trying to discuss for a minute how to staff. That's a lot of people, and we are, under any scenario, by December 31 on the hook to get 40 plus, 30 plus, 140, 210 people into the field. And depending on exactly what the wording is of the agreement with DOD, we may need to backfill the 109 positions that DOD filled simultaneously with getting the 300 out. We're not sure if that's going to be sequential or simultaneous. So it's a significant plus up. We've been asked, are you doing this with direct hires? Are you doing this with 3161s? Are you doing this with contractors? Are you doing this with coalition partners? We have, through a really robust interagency process that I'm actually proud of because it's really the U.S. government at its finest in this one, we have actually come up with some guiding principles that we in the field agreed with. We will be guided by these principles in filling each of the positions that comes in from the field. Proven ability to work in a difficult foreign environment. The field asked us to make that number one for reasons I think all of you who have field experience can appreciate. Number two, the field added this, ability to live in really tight, cramped conditions harmoniously. Then the third part is best match for the skill set needed. Fourth is ability to deploy in the time frame needed. And the fifth is value for money. And so that obviously, you know, can be, contractors are sometimes more expensive than direct hire, which pulls against it. We are working through the categories with AID, which has tremendous depth of experience in contracting capacity. So, for example, agribusiness, where we're asked to round up 24 people for the PRTs throughout the three phases. We will work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to see to what extent they have direct hires who match those criteria and are prepared to go. So we're scrubbing job descriptions against direct hires. But we're also looking at an oncoming AID. AID has a contract that they're just about to finish, put the finishing touches on, that would allow them to hire agribusiness folks by contract. So we'll probably end up with a mix in that category. When you turn to medical people, that's almost going to have to be contracted because we just don't have, we don't have capacity floating around in the government. City management and engineers, we will very likely turn to aid with some of their partnership arrangements that they have at state and local government to try to contract that in. Again, city planning is not a skill set that's floating around in the federal government agencies. And so there is a mix. Rule of law, we've gone first to the Department of Justice, which is doing a detailed scrub of the position descriptions that have come in the field to look and see where the matches are. So it will be a combination, but that's the process that we're using to go through this. Okay, I think I've used up exactly 15 minutes.
Thank you very much for your time, Linda.
Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Linda Granfield, former PRT commander in Jalalabad, Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan, from May of 2005 to May of 2006. I actually spent about 16 months in Afghanistan. I was previously down at 76 working for the J9 and General Kamiya, the 76th commander. Keep in mind, this presentation and what I have to say is really my perspective and what I experienced over those 16 months in Afghanistan. And also, I'm very passionate about PRTs. So if that comes through, because I speak very rapidly, you'll know why. It was really absolutely the best job of my life, that 16 months in Afghanistan, because I actually, for the first time in my military career as a civil affairs officer, really had the pieces and parts of what Barbara was talking about to accomplish the mission. Just some background information on PRTs and how they got established in Afghanistan. They were actually called coalition liaison teams or chiplets. They were put in place in remote areas just to basically assess the needs of the human population, implement small-scale reconstruction projects, things like wells, establish relationships with UNAMA. So the locations were very strategic where they placed them. To augment the CA effort in 2002, President Karzai, in cooperation with the U.S., decided that we needed to do something more, and so they expanded the program and established the first PRTs. Originally, they were coined as regional reconstruction teams, but Minister Jalali and the President renamed them to PRTs because of the provincial focus. And really, I think that's a very important political statement. The first PRT centered on providing a robust force protection platoon from the National Guard, civil affairs teams, and representatives of the U.S. government, civilian agencies, Department of State, USAID, USDA, as well representative from the central government, from the Minister of Interior. PRTs were absolutely an ad hoc unit that ranged from 45 personnel to 100 personnel, depending on the location and the relative security in the province. Each PRT had two civil affairs teams, a police advisory team, staff, translators, and then Afghan skilled and unskilled labor, which is a critical component to the PRTs. First PRT was in Gardez, and then followed to Bamyan, Kunduz, Mazar Sharif, Kandahar, and Herat. Quite honestly, I call this spoking of the wheel, and it's very, very key to how to strengthen the central government. You know, if you can spoke the wheels in Jalalabad and Kandahar and Mazar Sharif and Herat, you can then build from there and start spoking out. That's the only way the central government is going to be able to extend, you know, the reach out into provinces. Obviously, as I said, they were political, but PRTs were also seen as a means for dealing with the causes of Afghanistan's instability: terrorism, warlordism, unemployment, and grinding poverty. Right now, there's a total of 24 PRTs under ISAF control. 8 of those remain U.S. And honestly, from my perspective, PRTs are nothing new to the civil affairs community or doctrine, just a different name. The concept is the capability of the PRT to provide a linkage to the population, military, and government. Actually, in civil affairs doctrine, if you look at it, we have such a term and a concept which is called CMOC, or Civil Military Operations Center. CMOC is and functions much like the PRT. And honestly, the PRT experience for me was natural, since I've been doing this as a civil affairs officer. Coming into the PRT is absolutely a best fit. And although this is the first time that I've had the significant funding authority and reps from the interagency as part of the PRT construct, it's something that, quite honestly, as a civil affairs officer, you know, that's what we're trained to do. And the other point about PRTs I'd like to make is they're absolutely a grassroots method for countering insurgency. PRTs are accessible to the people. They have to be. They are accountable to the people and to the government. You know, win the will of the people and they will keep you safe. They may not be able to stand up to the insurgency, but they know who and where the bad guys are. Unfortunately, not all those elements of the governments that are working in Afghanistan recognize that fact. They don't think it's countering an insurgency, but quite frankly, that's what it is. With that, Afghanistan has left a big impact on me. It's an amazing place. You know, from the simplicity of a farmer trying to in a remote village, trying to feed his family and to make it through another harsh winter, to a tapestry or a quilt, you know, pieces of the puzzle making up this interdependence and the complexity that Afghanistan is. And my piece was Nangarhar. For those of you, you know, that don't know where Nangarhar is, or just some historical context, it's the home of Haji Qadir, who was assassinated in 2002, the Tora Bora Mountains and the Khyber Pass. It's a historical and strategic gateway to Kabul. Any time in the history of Afghanistan that Jalalabad fell, then Kabul fell. So I think it was a pretty critical strategic province. So what is the PRT mission? When I was there, the PRT mission was there to create a moderate, stable, and representative Afghanistan capable of controlling and governing its territory. We focused our efforts on 3 lines of operation: promoting good governance and justice, enabling an effective Afghan security apparatus through training and mentorship. The SERP program, when I first got there, the Commander's Emergency Response Program monies could be used to help the police, but eventually that was changed, so we were left with just training and mentoring the ANP, the Afghan National Police, and the Border Patrol. The last thing was facilitating reconstruction development and economic growth, ultimately creating the conditions for self-sufficiency, enduring prosperity, and a secure and stable environment in the province. The mission set has changed now, and it's to conduct civil-military operations in order to extend the reach of the central government, and they're focused on governance, rule of law and human rights, security and economic and social development. The reason for the change that came about, the original lines of effort were built by Lieutenant General Eikenberry at the CFC Alpha, and they were formed from the interim Afghan National Development Framework. For those of you that are not familiar, you can find that actually on the Afghan website. It was taken from an earlier document that President Karzai wrote, which was Securing Afghan's Future. It's a must-read for all those people working in Afghanistan. No matter if you're an NGO or you're a government employee, whatever it is, you need to read those documents to understand, because President Karzai has a very good understanding of what his people needs. He knows his strengths, he knows his weaknesses, he knows the tribalness of Afghanistan and what areas that need to be focused on. PRT composition, as I spoke about earlier, the Afghanistan U.S. PRTs were comprised, and except for the Panjshir PRT, that was actually the first Department of State led PRT. My husband actually was fortunate enough to be the deputy commander. And so, I mean, that's a good model for, I think, where the Iraq PRTs came from. It was normally a military commander, myself, normally a lieutenant colonel either in the civil affairs or infantry, two civil affairs team, a civil affairs team Bravo, and a civil affairs team Alpha, a force protection platoon, an ad hoc staff, and I emphasize ad hoc, a police advisory team, communications, DOS, USAID, and USDA. 40 to 100 people. The first few PRTs were ad hoc. Their pieces and parts rotated in on an individual or team basis, which is problematic to include the interagency. In most cases, there were interagency reps at all commands, the PRT, the regional command, CJTF 76, and CFC Alpha. This is still the case for ISAF, from my understanding. Many of the ISAF PRTs or regional commands have United States interagency representation, which is important. Now it's shifted in Afghanistan. The PRTs are comprised of Air Force or Navy commanders and their staff for the core PRT, minus the force protection and civil affairs. Those still remain a National Guard force protection platoon that's coming out of a battalion from some state, and then United States Army Reserve Civil Affairs. Right now, they're training up in Fort Bragg. They trained up last year for 3 months prior to their deployment into Afghanistan. I was replaced by an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who actually came off the command select list, which is an important fact. Previously, PRT commanders were picked by a local board, so sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. They actually fill the joint manning document. There's a manning document out there that has about 100 people on it, and they actually come together, like I said, as a unit. So he has a complete staff that actually is, you know, an intel officer, an operations officer, an admin officer, and they're actually trained in those skills. The people that I had may or may not be an operations officer, an admin officer, or intel officer, which made it difficult to accomplish the things we needed to. And keep in mind, PRT commanders do not command and control the interagency piece. Military commanders like to control everything, and some of those that tried to control the interagency piece weren't very successful because the interagency is not commanded by the PRT commander. The military commander is the military commander. It's very much a teamwork effort, at least it was for our PRT. Originally, the way that PRTs worked, they were OPCON, which is operational control for the strategic motive that was located in Bagram. It was a civil affairs brigade. That was problematic because the brigade commander, that brigade combat team, didn't have any say over to what the PRTs were doing. So you saw a lot of different focus for the PRTs, weren't necessarily synced with what the maneuver guys were doing, and it absolutely has to be synced because they complement each other. PRT guiding principles, it does no good to build a school if there are no teachers, books, or budget to sustain the building. PRTs are no longer focused on projects of the past. We're not doing wells, we're not doing schools, we're not doing clinics. We're focused on a systems approach. That's something that Major General Kamiya pushed during his time as a commanding general. And we used SERP, as I spoke about, the Commander's Emergency Response Program, to facilitate a 3, 6, 9, and 12-month program that actually nested with the USAID mission and what USAID was doing. Roads are at the top of that priority, and not just because it enables freedom of movement. And it took me 8 hours to get from my furthest district, which was only 70 kilometers. The maneuver battalion and PRTs must be synced. I spent a great deal of time coordinating the efforts and the focus with the Marine Battalion Commander, who's 2 kilometers down the street, and this enabled both of us to be in sync and to focus the efforts of the provincial leadership, because it's absolutely mentoring those provincial leaders. PRTs are functional commands. What I mean by that is we focus on the diplomatic, information, and economic elements of national power, while the military somewhat in that we were focused with the Afghan National Police and the Border Patrol, whereas the military was focused on ANA, mentoring the ANA, and doing kinetic ops, but they didn't do just kinetic ops. A lot of times we supplemented their projects and the CERT programs and their systems so that they were nested with the provincial government and the national level structure. And I'm getting the 5-minute thing. Challenges to success: corruption, limited human capital, low development baseline, poor construction design standards and techniques, attacks on the infrastructure and efforts, lack of resources from the central government. Last year, 60% of that was pledged under the donors conference, I think it was $11.4 billion, only 60% was spent because they didn't have the capacity to implement the other 40%. Sure, as tribal justice and a strong rule of force in conservative rural areas undermine national and provincial judicial systems, especially problematic with customs and land reforms. Low salary, high employment in rural areas, low education. I mean, I could go on, and it's not the Afghans' fault. I mean, they've been fighting for 30 years, and they're truly dynamic people. They overcome most things that they're faced with. Our strengths, I've highlighted several things. One of the things that we did really well was work together as an interagency process. As I spoke about, I didn't command and control those interagency people. We sat down probably every other morning, had coffee, and talked about how we were going to strategize what it was each of our agencies needed to accomplish in the province. And so, I mean, those are some of the things that worked well for us and why we were so successful. We developed a robust engagement strategy that included key communicators in the province as well as the mullah and village elders. You can't underestimate the mullah community, either in Iraq or in Afghanistan, because what's said on Friday in the mosque is what happens in the province, absolutely. And lastly, we mentored the provincial leadership. Governor Shirzai and I were best friends, tried to push him to be a very transparent governor. If you know the history, he came from Kandahar, very much a warlord, very strong personality, so it took a lot. We mentored the Afghan National Police. You know, met almost daily with the police chief and the Afghan Border Patrol, as well as the provincial council. So I'm keeping with my 5 minutes. I know it was a lot I threw at you. I know I talk very quickly. That's because, you know, there's so much I want to say, and I only had 15 minutes. So that's just a realistic approach to PRTs, despite negative press, despite the fact that NGOs complained about it. I had NGOs on my PRT almost every day. So we work together, you know, as stakeholders, because we recognize that we have to get together and come up with a solution for Afghanistan, because we need to use the limited resources that we all come to the table with. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. Those were insightful remarks, and hopefully will lead to some discussion about lessons from Afghanistan that could be used in Iraq. And on that vein, Bob? I'm timing you, buddy.
I want to join Paul in thanking you all for coming. It took a lot, I know, to come out in this weather. And I particularly want to thank Barbara Stevenson for coming. I've worked on a report, which is on the desk out there, on PRTs for about the last 3 months or so, and focusing on PRTs in Iraq. And everyone that I talk to told me, you got to go talk to Barbara Stevenson, because she's the motive force behind PRTs in Iraq. She really is just an exceptional leader in this field. And I'm also very happy to see Linda Granfield again. When I got to Jalalabad, Linda was taking over command of the PRT in Jalalabad. And for those of you that were in Afghanistan, you know that Jalalabad was the PRT in Afghanistan. It's the place that got all the visitors, because it was by far the best. It's nice to have her here with us this morning. USIP has been involved in the study of PRTs for about 2 to 3 years now. The first publication that came out of this effort was by Mike Jajak, who's our colleague in the back of the room there, which focused on this issue of the relationship between the military and NGOs in conflicted environments, particularly in circumstances where the United States is a combatant and not a disinterested third party. Our second effort involved a program that I ran, which looked at lessons learned in PRTs in Afghanistan. we went out and interviewed about 70 people who'd served in PRTs. I went out under the auspices of AID, visited PRTs, and the result of that effort is a study that's also on the table as you go out on PRTs in Afghanistan. Our third effort is focused on PRTs in Iraq, and as I said, I began this about 3 months ago, and I've been around to all the agencies that are engaged in this effort and has talked to as many people as I can. I think that maybe what I'll do is this morning to start is just to use my time to talk about the third kind of PRT that hasn't been mentioned yet. PRTs, somebody said, well, a PRT is really a brand name, you know, because it doesn't really describe exactly what we're doing in all instances. A provincial reconstruction team, as you'll see, the ones in Afghanistan work at the provincial level. The original 10 in Iraq worked at the provincial level, but these new PRTs that are being embedded and going out to Baghdad will work at municipal, district level, and at other levels of government. What I'd like to talk about is the original 10 PRTs in Afghanistan to give you a sense of what that experience was like. And I think as I talk, you'll see how the program that Barbara has described benefits and learns from the experiences of the first year in Iraq and promises to be a much more effective program. Not to belittle the really creative and efforts of those people that serve in the existing PRTs, but I think, you know, we've obviously learned a great deal about how to do this over from these three different kinds of experiences. I think maybe the easiest way to do this is to give you a rundown of what the original 10 PRTs in Iraq look like. These PRTs were focused on capacity building, at least that's what their message said, capacity building at the provincial level. And this is a critical mission because under the Coalition Provisional Authority, authority in Iraq was decentralized. Under the regime of Saddam Hussein, as you know, Iraq was a very highly centralized government and economy. And so when CPA came in and pushed things down to the provincial level, people at that level weren't really ready for those kinds of responsibilities initially. And so having an institution that worked at the provincial level and assisted those people, particularly newly elected representatives on the provincial councils, was essential. The original PRTs in Iraq are made up of about 60 to 90 personnel. The State Department has the lead. The senior team leader is generally a State Department senior foreign service officer. This person is the face of the PRT. He's the person that interfaces with the leading provincial authorities. He's the person that sort of sets the tone. The original PRTs either benefited or suffered from, not clear which, a lack of overall guidance. Initially, there was no real concept of operation, and there were certainly no rules of engagement or whatever, and so people were given a great deal of latitude in order to make their way. And so the team leader had a lot of influence. He did not, however, have control over all the members of his team. Being a State Department officer, he was not able to command the military people under his in his PRT. Now, everyone that I've talked to said this was never a problem, and the relationships between the military and civilian in PRTs was very good, but it was more of a, look, this is a job that needs to be done, and somebody volunteering, than it was, you know, you will go do this. The deputy team leader was a senior military officer, often a lieutenant colonel. His most important relationship, particularly for those PRTs that were on forward operating basis, was with the brigade commander. And in cases where the brigade commander and the senior military guy and the PRT get along really well, the PRT did very well. This is to say that I don't think this is going to be a problem anymore. If you heard all of the things that have been going on in terms of sorting out who's in charge and how things work, you know, are moving to correct problems that surfaced or potential problems that surfaced in the original PRTs. Subordinate to the deputy team leader, another military officer who was in charge of movement and security. Under him, a rule of law coordinator, often from the Department of Justice, somebody whose job it was to liaise with local courts. In Iraq, as most of you know, police training and judicial assistance are under the military, not under PRTs, and so this is a rather limited mandate. In addition to these people, there were two people from the State Department, both of whom had responsibility for liaising with local authorities, for reporting back to the embassy and to state, and taking charge of public diplomacy and public information. There was supposed to be an agricultural advisor in all the first 10 PRTs. Actually, USDA got its first person out to post in December. More is supposed to follow. A primary person in all of this was the AID representative. That's the person who chaired the development committee and who looked after all of the development-related activities. There was a governance assistance group. These were contractors under a USAID contract from a company called RTI International. RTI International started in Iraq in 2003, very early. Most of their personnel were not Americans. They were people drawn from the region who spoke Arabic and had extensive experience. RTI had its people in the field and very often was able to work in ways that perhaps other members of the PRT couldn't. There was a bilingual, bicultural advisor, often a someone from the region, but who was either an American citizen or a coalition citizen, who served as an advisor to the team and also as a liaison person with local governance. And then there was a U.S. Army civil affairs team that worked in a variety of different roles and often provided the people that sort of filled in when there was nobody to do a particular job. And lastly, there were the people that were in charge of protection. And on forward operating bases, those were soldiers. And in areas where the PRT based off of an embassy, a regional embassy office, these were contractors. I want to make a couple or three points. See how many come out in this. First of all, you have to understand PRTs, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, in a larger context. My question when I got out to Jalalabad was, how does this small little group of Americans survive in a really hostile environment? And what I discovered was that 2 kilometers down the road, as Linda said, there was a Marine combat battalion, and there was a helicopter, gunship squadron parked out back, and there was an ANA unit, and there were all kinds of folks around to provide protection, and it was an integrated effort. And that's largely the situation in Iraq as well, not only on the security side, but also on the development side. And when Barbara mentioned national development programs, the PRT is a piece of that. But for example, the aid person in the PRT doesn't run the development effort in the province. The PRT person is a part of that effort. Program is a national program coordinated on a national scale, and so you don't have these various little groups trying to do their own thing, or at least you shouldn't. Let me see. Flummoxed by the 5-minute note. The three major areas of concentration for the original 10 PRTs were governance, security, and reconstruction. And maybe I should say a little bit about security. Both in Afghanistan and Iraq, the primary security function of a PRT is force protection. PRTs really don't have a security function except to be a presence. And the mere fact of a group of American soldiers, you know, operating in an area gives an area a certain amount of stability. But we shouldn't think of the PRTs as a fighting instrument. That's just not their purpose. One of the more interesting things that I came across in looking at the first 10 PRTs was the relationship between the PRTs, the brigade, and how soldiers performed who were a part of this. And I think this has now been resolved as well. Barbara shaking her head. You know, in the beginning, the State Department asked the Defense Department to provide security escorts. The base commander, the battalion, the brigade commander found soldiers to take these civilians out. Nobody trained these soldiers to do close protection. Very often in the beginning, if they were attacked, the soldiers did what soldiers do. They stood and fought. That was not quite what the State Department had in mind in terms of close protection for VIPs. And so this has been, and this is just an example of how this has been a learning experience for all parties. And I think from what Barbara said,
we've included a memorandum in November that makes clear that the MMTs will be trained to protect the protectee.
Yeah. So I think this is best understood in a way as a work in progress. There is a paper out there, the third paper in the series of USIP papers on PRTs, this one, which just got finished a couple of days ago, which deals with PRTs in Iraq, and which will be updated based on the briefing that we've gotten today. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
At this point, the microphones are open, and I'd welcome you all to come up. And when you have your opportunity to ask a question, please state your name, your affiliation, and then the person to whom you'd like to direct your question. And I'd like to lead off first, and this is a broad observation. One of the issues that has plagued the United States' effort in Iraq has been the issue of strategic communications or public diplomacy, however you wish to define it. And the multinational force Iraq headquarters has an office that is supposed to be focused on strategic communications, yet it seems to not be succeeding in its work. What's going to be done with the PRTs so that there is some synergy between the PRT and MNFI and the embassy itself to get the message out?
I guess that one was to me,
Paul. That would go to you, yeah.
I think we've recognized the weakness, and we have public diplomacy spots on the PRTs, but despite the fact that our overall recruiting effort is really a good one. We've got a 98% fill rate, 65 of 66 foreign service officer positions are filled at PRTs. We have a real shortage of public diplomacy officers in the State Department, and so efforts to try to bolster those to add more people, more public diplomacy officers have run into a general service-wide shortage of public diplomacy officers. Some of our PRTs are, doing just what the SIGA report praised them for doing, which is that brilliant kind of creative ad hocery that you admire foreign service officers for. I know Stephanie Miley, our PRT leader in Tikrit, actually one of her working mottos is we have two tools, money and the media. And so she's completely tied in with her local media, using it, interviewing for them frequently, getting them invited to town meetings so that you shine a light in transparency on it, and then it's more difficult to carry out corruption and backroom things. This, though, is it's an ad hoc and it's a localized communication strategy. And I think it is, Paul, I think you've raised a really good question. One of the just overarching difficulties in Iraq is how many of us there are and how these huge operations, and it's very hard to get PRTs to plug into the MNFI STRATCOM outfit. I don't have a ready solution for you, but it is certainly one that I will take on board as needing more attention, because I think we don't get anybody falling over themselves praising the coherence of our communication strategy.
Paul, if I could just
say
one thing. One of the things that we did in Afghanistan, because we had the same issue, was to hire a local Afghan who had a degree in journalism. And he was totally interfaced with the local media and absolutely just wrote good news stories about what the PRT was doing, because it was very important. We ended up countering the same things over and over because, the Afghans were very, sometimes very critical, and they'd say, oh, you're not doing anything. And so we were highlighting those things continuously, and that was actually a very effective tool. One thing we wanted to do was actually then hire stringers in each of the districts to do the same thing, to tie everything together. But I left and we didn't get that far. But it may be worth something to look at.
Bob, did you have anything?
No.
Okay. Stuart?
Hi, thanks. Stuart Patrick from the Center for Global Development. Barbara mentioned some of the civilian sources of funding for PRT projects, but I was more interested in hearing from Lieutenant Colonel Greenfield about the military funding and both perspective in Iraq, but also some of the lessons that you have from the SERP funds in Afghanistan. I'm very interested in whether or not you have any reflections on the sort of requirements for their effective use, and also whether or not there are any legislative or other authorities that would be particularly useful going forward, presuming that SERPA is going to be, I mean, it seems very popular amongst U.S. military officials and also civilian officials, and there's a lot of talk about expanding that, so any reflections you might have from your experiences would be most welcome. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, the SERP guidelines, the Commander's Emergency Response Program, I don't have the guidelines in front of me, but there are such guidelines, and it's actually mandated by Congress. I mean, that's where the congressional authority comes through the funding, from my understanding. And there are certain parameters, things that you can and can't do. For instance, you cannot pay salaries. And we also use ODACA, which is overseas, sir, help me out here,
Development Humanitarian Action
monies. But that's a very long process, because it comes all the way back actually to State Department, because I believe they have the purse strings on that. We looked at long-term type of projects, schools and clinics, you know, in conjunction with aid and the priorities from the Ministry of Education and Health in Kabul. But those are the two funding sources that we used. Additionally, like for instance, in hiring my local employees, we actually used an O&M contract. We contracted a service through that normal contracting procedures, and that's how we were able to hire a local guard force to do because I was a forward operating base commander. Also, that's how I hired my public affairs person. That's how I hired my actual senior culture advisor / translator. So those are the three sources that I'm aware of. Additionally, then you have Salacia, which is the ability to pay for damages that may occur. And that's a legal issue. If, for instance, we run over somebody's house, we can actually compensate them, although it does not admit that we were wrong. It just says we're compensating you because you're out of house, basically.
And did over time, did you find that, I mean, one of the criticisms of SERP or observations about it is that it's very useful walking around money in many cases. Certainly was General Petraeus and others used it very effectively in Iraq, but that it wasn't always necessarily connected to, not that long-term development principles are necessarily easy to apply in a counterinsurgency context, but that they were in some ways quite stovepiped from broader efforts. You seem to suggest that that's changed over time.
That's changed, absolutely. General Kamiya and then under General Freakley, we come up with 3, 6, 9-month strategies, so we have to prioritize our programs as part of that system, and it's very much systems-focused. So that it's not just a road here or something that's not connected with those lines of operations. We have to show where that project, as part of a greater system, is going to be tied to those three lines of operation. So it's changed quite a bit. It's not walking around money.
Okay. Please.
My name is Hank Nichols. I'm from the Army Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute. And actually, I was in a PRT in Afghanistan for a year as an AID officer. And as a former civil affairs officer, I'm trying to find, I'm sorry, Alan, all Boston Pentagon, Allen's not here, because as they put these military people into the specialist position, what I'm trying to find out is how do they validate their credentials? Because in the past, it's always been self-certifying, unless you had a professional license or you were a U.S. government employee, and it was, you know, you may end up with a high school teacher trying to advise how to set up a national education system. And I was just wondering, what's the method they're going to use to validate the credentials of the military people they put into these specialist positions?
Barbara, would that be you?
I mean, we have a partial answer from DOD saying that they will do this. The process so far is that first, just very general description of the job, like we need somebody who is a civil engineer, for example, and then a capsule position description came in from the field. This point you raised, I mean, the idea was to try to go through and match skill sets, particularly where people are reservists or National Guard and they are city managers in their real life. This would be a good sign that they'd be pretty darn good city managers, you know, to a PRT. But this, you raise a good question, and we haven't gotten that far into how DOD is going to validate these skill sets. And I think the one you raise is a really important one, because, as you say, somebody who is a teacher is not actually equipped to do on a national level an education system. And I think we've carried that. We've actually expected, for example, often somebody
that serve, you know, works in the Department of Education in Washington, let's face it, administering federal grants, to somehow then be transformed because they work for the Department of Education to be capable of setting up a school system in the developing world. I think we've had this problem kind of throughout, is assuming on the faintest of evidence that this actually was somebody who was going to be able to do development work in a very difficult environment. And we are trying to get at that in the positions that we're filling under, the teams that are under me, with actually trying to come up with those criteria, which if you've got proven experience in a difficult environment, you've probably done some development work that we're going to be able to look at. Because I think doing a job domestically in the Department of Energy does not necessarily make you the right person to set up a transparency system in the Cape Kurdish region for getting oil out. It's just it's a different set of skills. And I think it's been not just the DOD part, I think it has run throughout.
And lastly, I'll just follow up what Bob said. Linda's all about PRT. It was first-class synchronization, where the rest of us were sometimes fits and starts, but they really synergized their effort.
Thank you. George?
Thanks. George Devendorf with Mercy Corps. Mercy Corps has been operational in Afghanistan since about the mid-'80s and in Iraq since spring of 2003. Linda, you made a number of excellent points in your presentation. One of them was underscoring the importance of accessibility, that PRTs be accessible, I guess, both to local populations, of course, and then also to the various civilian actors that will be performing reconstruction and development tasks in a given area. In Iraq, that relationship in some ways presents a really critical challenge. Mercy Corps, like many organizations inside Iraq, civilian reconstruction organizations, operates outside the wire without any armed protection. We work at a community level almost entirely through national staff members, and have been reasonably successful in a tough environment. My question really, Barbara, I think is for you, but also for Bob or anyone else, and that is, looking forward, especially as more PRTs come online and as it looks like most of them being co-located with military forces, how do you foresee PRTs maintaining their accessibility in a way that doesn't either, one, intimidate locals, or two, potentially undermine the security of civilian actors trying to do reconstruction and development tasks in country? Thanks.
The model that you, first of all, the problem you raise is just so fundamental. And, you know, there's a completely sort of a 180 degree divergence in how do you provide security. You know, the one is that you just surround it by helicopters and armored vehicles and you go guns blazing. And then I think certainly the NGOs would have a view that blending is actually a better idea. And so you find these two, you just find an ideological, theological difference about what makes you safer. We are working in really close partnership with AID on trying to fill these 300 slots, and AID is making this point emphatically that there is nothing in here that says as you fill those criteria that you actually need to fill all these specialist jobs with a direct hire American with a top secret clearance who lives inside the wire. And in fact, if we are thinking about long-term sustainability, we have an increasing cost issue because we are really being scrutinized for costs. And if you're thinking about, you know, what is this going to look like a few years out, the way you're describing it, where you really do build your program through people who can live outside the wire and have that access, I think we have got to be part of shifting that mindset. And obviously, there is concern on my part that in the embedded one, it is very hard to imagine that being real. We are looking at kind of a novel concept for Najaf, where the provincial support teams, have you heard that concept? They are really, and Najaf, we can't afford to have a presence there. We have no military presence, and we can't create a standalone civilian presence for the reasons that were just described. You know, how in the world do you put people in a hostile environment with no military there? But we're looking at using the provincial support team, which are all Iraqi nationals who were hired from our hub in Hilla and who maintain an operation there. Would we be able to, with military escort, go in every couple of weeks, do a series of meetings, get some grant, you know, business rolling, and then go back out with the locally engaged staff carrying the presence on? I think we're going to have to start looking very much at those kind of models, because otherwise you're not really teeing yourself up to have a long-term sustainable impact. So we're surging right now and going in this one direction, but as we keep saying, we are surging in order to accelerate the transition to Iraqi self-reliance. And these two are in tension as you try to implement, and you have to think all the time about what are you doing, because you have to do it to make the surge work, but can you do it in a way that would allow you to look more like your model? You articulated it great, so thanks for reinforcing it.
I would just like to say that one thing, I offered hot dogs and pizza, so people love to come to the PRT to eat lunch, and then that opened the door. I mean, it's simple things like that, is looking for ways to consensus build. The other thing that we did was we created, for instance, a hospital task force committee with the director of public health. So when the military had to do a med project somewhere, we made sure it was synced with the healthcare industries in the province that were doing healthcare, because they were going to have to stay in those clinics long after we go. I mean, I recognized early on I'm not the development healthcare, you know, specialist that the NGO world does. And part of my job or my mission, I felt like, was to make it safe and secure for you guys to be able to go do that. And so we just looked for stakeholders and tried to come together with, okay, understanding we have different missions, we have different philosophies, but how do we work together to build that partnership, still keeping you safe by not having you, you know, be seen, oh, you're, you know, associated with the military and all those causes. But, I mean, I think that's what we have to get to it at a certain point. And so I appreciate, you know, the work that you guys have done. And so that's the strength, you know, because we need to continue, you know, that partnership.
I'm Bill Hsu. I'm retired from USAID. I'm a consultant in civil military coordination. I worked back in the 1960s in the original civil military organization called CORTS. And I'm curious about to what extent did the CORTS experience influence, or how, to what extent was it looked at in coming up with the tenets for the PRT program?
Well, I've got a huge stack on CORTS, and we've done a fair bit of reading, and we certainly know I mean, we generally regard it as a model that, despite the loss of the political will and the loss of the war, that the actually CORTS was working, and that I think we've all come around to a consensus that CORTS is a great place to go look for models. I think we recognize we have some structural problems here, just some capacity issues here. I mean, there were a lot of AID officers out there in CORTS. I think there might have been 5,000 of them, and that was out of a total AID direct hire of about 15,000 at the time. And, of course, AID is now down to 2,100 direct hires, only half of whom are foreign service. So you're looking at
a lot of people who were hired,
you know, to do this,
come in
to surge.
To do that, yes, not on contracts, so but as direct hires.
I had a former CORDS commander tell me over lunch a couple of weeks ago that he trained for an entire year with his team before he went out. They knew the language, they knew the culture, and they knew how to operate together. We are struggling to fit in 5 days before we send out these PRTs, but of course, because of course the demand for getting people on the ground quickly is so pressing. I think the saturation level was pretty intense in Vietnam. I think it is considerably higher than what we're able to do. And I also think, why is that? I think it is lack of civilian capacity. I mean, the State Department is sitting at 6,500 diplomats, which is not very high. Aid has gone from 15,000 down to 1,200. So you've less than 10,000, like, if you took all of us all over the world, that's the entire corps. I just asked some of our partners, how big is your diplomatic service? And the Brits have 5,000, even though they have one-fifth of our population. But they have only 130,000 men under arms compared to 1.4 million for us. So we really do have a very diminished civilian capacity. So we don't have a lot, and we keep kind of calling on it. But as I keep saying, I'm not going to say which office because I revealed it this morning, it caused a problem. But we call for volunteers, for the best and brightest to be PRT leaders. We had instantaneous answer. We had far more volunteers than we could take. But we took the best and the brightest. We took the director and the deputy director of a crucial country whose leader may die and will have severe ramifications for the United States. We took them both and said, deal with it. You know what I mean? But when you take these people out, you're leaving a gap because we, of course, have no training float. So I think it really does come back to, we just don't have a lot of civilian capacity here. And you can't grow it instantaneously. And we've been unsuccessful talking to the committees on the Hill that appropriate for the civilian agencies to get them to actually accept that there is a national security dimension to these constant budget cuts on the civilian side. So I think that's part of the answer.
Sure.
Norm Olson, Achievable Solutions. And I guess I would continue Bill's questioning. I was a CORDS guy too. province senior advisor. I had 200 men on my team.
There you go.
So when you talk about a major effort and recruiting 300 people,
exactly.
With a cataclysmic disaster facing the United States, mm-hmm. strikes me as rather modest.
Yeah.
And you talked about the best and the brightest, and I recall the United States Navy on two occasions sent me nuclear submariners who were XOs, exceptionally able men with excellent interpersonal skills. But, dealing with Admiral Rickover is a whole lot different than dealing with a Vietnamese villager. So they weren't really very effective as public affairs officers, although I think it made them better officers overall. But my question really to Linda is, I identify with your saying that was the best job you ever had. I would say that was the best job I ever had until I coached my son and daughter's soccer team. What qualities would you look for PRT members? What results do you think you can reasonably get in what time frame? And I would note here that I think Senator McCain is the most optimistic man on the Hill, and he's saying he wants to see results by September. And what level of casualties and what level of risk do you think is acceptable for PRTs?
Qualities. I think you need somebody that is absolutely flexible, adaptable, has great negotiation skills, has great people skills, and understands culture and what makes people tick. And it's an art. It's definitely not a science. I mean, I think there's some skills that you come to the table with, training, master's degrees in international relations, regional studies courses, negotiations courses, those sorts of things. But I think at the end of the day, it definitely takes a special kind of person, and I don't know if you could get that by looking at a resume. I think you need to see a person interact. I think you need to see a person, deal with, a complex situation, and you're the only person and the governor staring at you, wanting a response. I mean, you have to be able to be quick and think, quickly on your feet. As far as results go, I think the United States, unfortunately, looks at things very short term. And this is my personal opinion, that if you look back at Germany, Japan, and Korea, and I just left Korea, I was there teaching a joint civil affairs course to the Koreans, is we're still there. We're still in those three countries with a presence, with a military presence, with a political presence, with monetary and fiscal support. And I think that we need to look at this in the same context. I think, part of our strength of being a democracy is, we debate things. But the bad guys see that as a weakness because they think that they can influence, the American debate in Congress and other places, and I think that may be a dangerous thing. We may expect too much too quickly, and I just don't think we can get there. That's my thing. As far as risk and casualties, I mean, it's inherent risk. I mean, we were IED'd, we were shot at, but that didn't stop us from going outside the wire because the population is who we needed to reach out, because the insurgency is living in the population. And so I'm not going to put a number or figure on those things because I don't think you can. I mean, it's an inherent risk in what we're doing. It's something that we have to do. We can take precautions to make sure that we try to overcome some of those things, and I think we're working hard to do that. The other thing is having that local population and pulling people to be our FOB security helped us because the people saw their own people there. Additionally, we took the police and the border patrol everywhere we went when we moved outside of the city. That's so the Afghans could see their government working for them. Oh, it's the police. They're coming with the coalition. They must be doing something that the government wants them to do. And so, I mean, those are important things that, and then it also built capacity. We taught them how to do, going in and talking with village elders, how to give out, relief supplies when there was a flood. I mean, or go to a return camp, returning cluster for, people coming back from Pakistan into Afghanistan. I mean, those are some of the things, techniques that we use to build that relationship.
So Bob, you had a comment?
Answered your question.
Yeah, I have a question that I want to check with Barbara on. When I was at the Defense Department, I was told that the new PRTs, the civilians in the that will be embedded, will be subject to Department of Defense security regulations, not diplomatic security regulations, that the Defense Department regulations will permit greater access. It will permit people to be much more flexible and permit them to get out a lot more. But that the trade-off for being able to do the job perhaps more effectively is that there are more risks. Is that in fact the case?
You know, we are still actually trying to come to closure on the terms of the memorandum of agreement, and we concluded in November of 06 a security agreement that deals with the PRTs that are the six that are co-located on FOBs and divisions. It is a hybrid. It places the PRT members under the combatant command's security responsibility. It says military movement teams will protect them, but it also says they will protect them according to diplomatic security standard, and then it sets out some very specific training requirements so that the pool of soldiers who will serve on the military movement teams, all of the ones who are in the pool have been trained by the regional security officer, and they go after, it goes after that issue, you know, certainly of whether you stand and fight or whether you take a detour to protect the PRT. That is very clear for the existing PRTs. For the embedded PRTs, we are incorporating that agreement by reference, so it is incorporated into the larger MOA. At the same time, we are conceding that the tactical control for movement of security for the PRTs goes to the brigade commanders. And Bob, I think that the actual what goes under those kind of headers is still a bit of a work in progress. And I mean, certainly when we recruited the PRT leaders to go into the embedded teams, we tried to be as upfront as we could about the fact that this was going to be a more of a kinetic operation and that there was going to be a closer kind of embedding in the military than we have elsewhere. Some of our PRT leaders actually are former Marines or they're former Army officers, and so, you know, we actually thought that that was a good thing. But I think that this is a chapter that's still to be written as we actually work some of this out on the ground. Because it's a really delicate issue, from as you can imagine, and really a lot of the PRT people, though, as you'll know, they're frustrated by right. By their RSO security rules because they feel they can't get out of the wire enough. If they're going to be out there living in difficult situations, taking, you know, incoming mortars, they at least want to be out there shaping the environment and leave at the end of the year saying, I made a difference. And so it'll be very interesting to see which way it breaks, because don't assume they will complain that they are being subjected to greater risk. They may actually only focus on the fact that they're more able to get their jobs done, if that's how it plays out.
Yeah, and that was very different in Cords.
Daniel, sir, I'm at USIP. I first wanted to say, Barbara and Linda, that you know, your courage and commitment to this is really enormously admirable, and I think we all appreciate that. There's a but, of course.
I knew that was coming.
There's a but. The way I think of PRTs, in part at least, a simplified model of a PRT is a funnel that's bringing in resources and then going to spread out resources on the territory, and somehow by spreading those resources is going to help us stabilize difficult situations. The question I have is, both in theory or in the rules of engagement, Barbara, and then in practice on the ground in Afghanistan, how do you prevent those resources? And mind you, resources can mean jobs, it can mean a road, it can mean a bridge, it can mean other things besides money. How do you prevent those resources from being captured by the bad guys one way or another?
I think it's one of the critical challenges before us, Dan, and in Stuart Patrick's question about SERP. I mean, I think one of the things that we have certainly heard the criticism that short-term consent buying that SERP has sometimes been used for has, in fact, as the Iraqis say to us sometimes, rewarded bad behavior. As one of our senior officials puts it, fed the crocodiles. As Zen puts it, been captured by the bad guys. And I think we really do need to get that out on the table in the pre-deployment training for the new PRTs going out there, to have a real look at the cost of short-term consent buying. Because if your primary goal is to actually shape the environment so that this is not friendly territory for bad guys and it is more friendly territory for moderates who are having a very hard time getting breathing room in Iraq as the space is taken up by violent extremists, you really have to weigh whether whatever short-term consent you're going to get here for safe passage is worth ultimately growing the bad guys.
I actually intend to go teach that part of the course myself and hoping to make it vivid and memorable because I think this is one of the challenges. I know one of our coalition partners identified this as one of the biggest issues that they were facing in terms of trying to get strategic coherence, because they felt that a lot of their civilian resources were actually going to try to get the moderates enough breathing room to grow, and meanwhile the SERP money was actually just keeping everybody flowing into the militias, because they were the ones who were actually able to deliver schools and what, etc. So I think it's a central strategic problem that we need to get on the table and get a common way ahead about.
I would agree with those are excellent points. One of the things that we did was try to hire local construction or contractors that were from the area, and then we put another requirement that 50% of the workforce had to be from the village that they were doing said project in. It's problematic because, yeah, you may be paying, you know, there's strong guys in Afghanistan for a reason. But you also have to build capacity on the other hand. And so, you know, it's a dual-edged sword. One of the things that we did was create a construction trade center. It was a joint project between SERP money and USAID. And what it was designed to do was train people in five trades so they had long enduring skills, because we found that people just didn't know what they didn't know. I mean, showing up and work in sandals, probably not a good thing. You know, how to be safe. And so there were five areas, and it was a 30-day training program. And at the end of that training program, they were going back out to USAID schools and clinics that weren't built to standard to help rebuild and repair them to standard so that they were earthquake-proof and that they met those basic things. I don't know how you don't do it. One of the biggest complaints from the Afghans, though, is they wanted somebody local to have, you know, the project, because it was, you know, putting revenues there. They complained frequently about, you know, the Pakistanis and Indians and the Chinese and everybody else, but, you know, Turkish, except for us. Where, you know, we can't seem to get ahead, and we can never, you know, learn if we don't go, you know, learn. So, I mean, it is a dual-edged sword, I think.
Thank you.
My name is Nick Dowling. I'm with a company called IDS International, and we are involved with training brigade combat teams at the National Training Center in PRTs. And what they've asked us to do is bring out four experts who've served in Iraq or Afghanistan PRTs and integrate with their training effort completely in terms of the planning and the scenarios and the classroom training and so forth. And we've just completed our first rotation, training up the third brigade of the third ID that's going to be deploying to Iraq. Extraordinary experience, fantastic working with the brigade, and great that we could have interagency sort of training at the before you deploy, and so that a brigade, when it shows up, doesn't show up for the first time meeting a PRT on the ground, but rather it meets a PRT training element, at least beforehand. Two questions about this. Obviously, would be much preferred for it not to be contractors, but it to be real State Department, real USAID, real folks who are going to be going to PRTs to be part of that effort. And as I say to everyone, when we talk about this, we invite the folks that you're responsible for, if in those 4 days of training they have, if one of them may want to come and spend some time learning what it's like to operate with a brigade in an Iraq province before they deploy, we would love to be able to facilitate that. So the first question is, have you all thought about how we can get to interagency training? The second question is, I was very interested in your comment about shifting the emphasis of PRTs from what they have been focused on, which is things like governance, capacity building, to counterinsurgency, building moderates, reconciliation. And my question is, how do you do that? And that is that what programs or what does that really reflect in terms of a shift in the way you're going to use your resources to do that? And that's obviously valuable for us because we're going to start training a brigade February 24th. We want to know?
Yeah. On the interagency training program, we did get your invitation. Everybody would
love to have dumped their inboxes and done it. But as usual, the fact that we have 83 officers for every 100 jobs just got in the way of our taking part in it. So we appreciate the invitation. On the interagency training, the course that we're starting at the Foreign Service Institute, the pre-deployment training, it is interagency. It is the first time we've ever tried to do this. So we're going to train the interagency team. The civil affairs officers are coming back. AID is bringing their people back. Our PRT leaders will be in there. And we actually developed the curriculum with a very robust and spirited, I still have an unresolved issue I have to go sort out with my aid companions this afternoon, on what exactly are we spending this precious time doing. I mean, there was a big process of saying what the priorities were, and of course aid thinks in terms of implementation, state thinks in terms of policy and strategy, the military thinks in terms of how to ride in a convoy, so we had to put all that together, you know, in a really good training curriculum. So we've got one, it's the first time we've run it. And we're pulling in some of the top of the pops. I was just passing Linda a note saying, would you be free to teach? I was like, oh, we've got a star here. So we pulled it together with, there are some existing training programs AID had, that SDRS had, that we knew from the military, so we're pulling the modules together. So that's the part on training, is I actually think we're doing it. It's really compressed, and it is compressed because we need to meet the March 31 deployment deadline. What was your second part about?
It was about the shift in mission.
The shift. How are we going to make that real is a really good question. It is, part of it is through the training course. We actually are, we don't do doctrine on the civilian side. If you say doctrine, everybody sounds a little uncomfortable with it. But what we do is we teach, and we teach courses, and in there we give a curriculum. Well, that's what slide the doctrine in. So those of us who are teaching the course and designing this are actually doing interagency doctrine as we get the people to go out. So part of it will be through bringing, it's going to be through the training course of what does this actually look like, how do you make it real. That is our best hope, I think, at trying to get this through, is using the training course to develop some doctrine. We're not giving up, right, on capacity development, and we're not giving up on economic development, but we are asking people to look at it through a lens and to take into account the kind of trade-offs that Linda's just described. Because if you're going to try to source it, if you're trying to hire a lot of people locally in Iraq, most of these guys that show up for these jobs, we're told in certain areas, are actually the militias that are showing up, and so you're paying the militias. Some sources say that if you actually look at what you get from the interrogation after you pick up all these guys who've been trying to blow us up, 90% of them have jobs. And so you have some complex pictures here going on. And so we're going to have to teach people to make some balances about whether this is actually taking you more in the right direction or more in the wrong direction, because there are some real trade-offs about doing things locally and trying to build things. Sometimes you're actually buying into kind of a militia, mob, mafia operation. It may not be worth it. You may want to actually reconstruct this in a different way. I'm going to do some of my El Salvador experience of doing this with the Mayor's in Action program and the Ambassador's Quick Response Fund, where we were actually able to get, the FMLN had basically intimidated everyone. All the mayors had quit in the conflictive areas. No one would run because you would be killed. But we did run a program where we would make $100,000 available if you would run, have a town hall meeting in a transparent way, and do a project that mattered to the community with a certain amount of matching our money in kind. It was remarkable that you grew some really good local leaders out of this, because the people with the guts to stand up to the FMLN were people who cared more about providing a health care clinic for their kids and the kids of their sisters, etc., than they did about power. And you grew some really good people that way. It doesn't grow them overnight, but it's really important to think in terms of what this really can look like, because people who did courts, people who've done El Salvador, they have seen it work, and we can describe it and make it real, I think, for people.
I'm Mike Stanton. I'm from Senator Kennedy's office. I see one of the key members of your team would be a bilingual coordinator. I wonder if you could speak to the challenges of dealing in an environment with which very few Americans are familiar either with the language or with the culture. And secondly, what sort of coordination has been undertaken or is foreseen with the Iraqi national government in the operation of the PRTs?
I think you're absolutely right about the whole point about having to work with BBAs. I mean, I always take into account this point. When I was in El Salvador, I spoke Spanish, and my boss actually not only spoke Spanish from birth, but was married to a Salvadoran, and so we really knew this society, and I am aware that it is much harder to do through, you know, brain surgery with oven mitts, and I think that you've made a valid point. The second question, tell me again.
Any coordination
with the central government.
With the Iraqi National Operation.
Yes, actually. One core component of what we're asking the PRTs to do in terms of this capacity building isn't just training. It's also actually making it possible. I mean, our PRT leader in Saladin made us her mission statement. At the end of this, she wanted to have, you know, a provincial government in the Sunni heartland able to intercede effectively with a Shia-dominated government in Baghdad and bring home the money it needed to implement its budget in the province. And so really her whole work plan has been, you know, about making the province-center link work. It's crucial because they're, unlike in Afghanistan, where you really just have a shortage of resource and lack of development, that is not so in Iraq. I mean, it's actually a rich country that's sitting with a lot of unrest. It's $10 billion of unspent capital in their capital budget. We need to get that money out of Baghdad, down into those provinces. So through our programs, we help them develop the project, develop the budget, use our good offices to get the meetings in Baghdad, sit in on the meetings, and then we ensure through project management units that we will be putting in those core ministries that the money gets pushed back out. We've also appointed Tim Carney, Ambassador Tim Carney, as the coordinator for economic transition. This is part of what he is also focusing on, is getting coordination between all the various elements of our mission, aid, IRMA, the econ section, the PRTs, and actually getting that Iraqi budget executed. So through the process of actually working these budgets and getting the money out, I think you do get a level of coordination because you're going to be working day to day on getting the projects done.
Barbara, since you brought up Tim's name, who will he be working with or for?
The ambassador.
For the ambassador. I'm sorry, Linda.
I'm sorry. I just would like to say, you know, World War II, if you go back in history, you know, civil affairs and the DOD, Department of State, or whatever the precursor was, sent 1,500 people in Japanese culture, language, that had special skills to the universities, you know, in that specialized in Japanese language and culture and training, and they spent, I think, 4 years, and then they went out, you know, or 18 months, something of that nature. It was a very condensed program, and I think that was 1,500 people. I mean, we haven't done that yet, you know, and recruited those kind of people that are interested in that and send them off and do those kinds of things.
You were also dealing with a defeated environment. I mean, you weren't putting your teams down in the middle of
ongoing conflict.
Right, I understand. But, I mean, I still think we need to get to that. I mean, I would love, you know, to be able to go and, you know, study for a couple of years and go back to Afghanistan and be able to speak the language because, you know, using a translator, although I had a phenomenal one, that was the exception and not the rule. And you, in order to get your message out and what you're doing, you really have to connect with the people in a way that, you know, they know.
How does the Karzai government coordinate with the PRT?
President Karzai came out to the province a couple times. He doesn't coordinate, obviously, directly, but his government does through the ministries. We work with the line directors in the province who work with the ministries in Kabul. Likewise, the Department of State and the USAID rep can go right back to an office that is working in the ministries. So we make sure that what it is we're trying to accomplish is nested, for instance, with the Minister of Education so that he's got the salary to pay the teacher and that that school is really on his list of priorities. Because what happens is you get requests that maybe aren't necessarily nested, but, you know, a villager wants a school in his backyard. And so those are the techniques. Additionally, now, since the provincial council has stood up, we made sure that the provincial council chairman was in every meeting that the governor had, so he knew what his governor was doing and the line directors were doing, because he's the only elected official, those 19 people in the province. The governor is not. He's appointed. So.
Ed?
Thank you very much. Edward Joseph with SAIS. I was a UN civil affairs officer for 3 years during the war in Bosnia and then a year on active duty with Army Civil Affairs after the war. And one of the things we learned, anyone who served in the Balkans knew this, was that to achieve anything, you had to be politically savvy. And Barbara, I think you've touched on this in a past couple of questions about this issue of bolstering moderates, which is obviously a very critical thing to do. But if you could go on a little bit more about the political context for this, because this is quite murky and sometimes very, very difficult stuff. Number one, will there be political officers attached to this? Number one. And number two, what does it really mean to, if that's the goal, I mean, sometimes the elected or appointed official is not a moderate.
Yep.
So are you going to, will they have the ability to shun the elected or appointed official and actually try to build up opposition to him. So if you could put the will it be part of a larger strategic context, Skiri, anti-Sodder, and so forth? Please.
Yep, you absolutely go right into how difficult this is. In the existing PRTs, there actually are political officers. They're called IPAOs, and there are one or two, I think, at every one of them. And it is classic political officer work. It's that business that we do. And you're right, it is murky. There are the core guidelines that we've articulated publicly are a moderate is prepared to work politically, peacefully, and under the rule of law to pursue his or her agenda. Cross-sectarian is often, very often added to that list. And transparently and reformer, these kinds of words do come up. It is murky, and sometimes what you're doing is you are looking at your provincial council and you're deciding it's a little bit murky, but basically I can moderate the powerful here by actually, you know, as I say, most leaders are gray and you can pull them up toward Mandela or down toward despots depending on how you use your assistance. So you should be constantly pulling them up, challenging them to live up their aspirations, shining a media spotlight on there, giving interviews yourself about, gee, wouldn't it be good if we had rules that actually govern procedures in these meetings here. So there are things that we have seen our PRT leaders do that can take a murky, mixed, kind of slightly corrupt, and start to pull it up and challenge them to, if it's Shia, to Dom, you know, to provide health care in a Sunni neighborhood. So you can pull people up. There is a tough judgment call, though. And sometimes I'm afraid you're absolutely right, is that we've got the council we're supposed to be working with is so far unredeemable that actually you need to think about starting to do something like I just described in El Salvador, which is create another kind of base for civic action, which is less about a grab for power and more about trying to provide services. The trouble is, instead of being at zero on the timeline, you're now at -2, because you've got to, first of all, grow that capability. So it's a longer-term one, and there will be some tough judgment calls in this. But there are political officers out there, and I shouldn't say this publicly because we're still working it, but we're hoping to do that with the embedded teams, too, but we're having to go back and forth, making sure that we've got some management issues resolved. But you're absolutely right. And talking through those issues in the training on the way out there, I think, is a critical component.
Thank you.
Mike, before you ask your question, I'd just like to, a panelist, let both questioners ask their questions since we're running out of time. And then you can respond. So, Mike, please.
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. Mike Jagies from the U.S. Institute of Peace. It's great to have you back with us, Barbara. And remarkable to see what you've done. I'd like to talk about the civilian reserve capacity issue. It came as something as a surprise, I understand, when DOD found out that they were going to be providing a third of the civilians for this purpose. And it should be a surprise because this is not a new problem. We've rediscovered this about every year for the last 10 years. And, you know, we need police, we need judges, we need agronomists, we need city managers. And even if we were to bring the State Department's budget up to what it should be, those are not core competencies of the State Department.
Yeah.
And if we keep, of course, the solution has always been ad hoc. You go to contractors.
Yeah.
It's impossible to have a learning curve and take lessons learned in doctrine and imbue that in 5 days in a constantly changing, shifting set of contractors. So we fundamentally have to have structural change if we're going to fix this problem. Now that we've rediscovered it again in a moment of crisis in our country, how can we actually, what would be your recommendations for how can we structurally change the way the U.S. government approaches this to be able to provide qualified people when we need them for these kinds of circumstances, not just PRTs, but wherever we might be needing to do this in missions?
Sir?
I may ask the toughest question at all.
Identify yourself, please.
But my name is Jim McKellar, and I work for Canberra Corporation. I'm a Stability Operations Program Manager, so I'm a contractor. And I'm asking a question of three government representatives from the state DOD and USAIP. But what I really want to know is from Jim McKellar's perspective, to Barbara and Linda and Bob, we talked about the Accords and noble efforts in a war that we lost. The question I have for you, in your opinion, why are PRTs the right answer to winning U.S. policy? Or ask another way, can you link PRTs up to a higher U.S. cause? Thank you.
let me
Barbara,
take a
please.
Why are PRTs important to kind of link it to a higher cause? Yeah, I can. I think the higher cause is making sure that that we don't leave Iraq in defeat. And certainly our military colleagues are convinced that we are a crucial component of their strategy, and their strategy is to go in with enough troops this time so that when you clear, you can actually hold, and the hold creates space for economic and political progress on the economic and political track to try to kind of reverse some really disturbing downward trends. We are, I think, an important arm. We bring something directly, and I do believe, I will be completely honest, I do believe our military colleagues overvalue what we bring in terms of direct outcomes. I don't think it's the 40,000 jobs that we're going to directly create through the Community Stabilization Program that's going to tip this. I do think it is much more that ability to work with the central government to help them troubleshoot their budget execution issues and get them on track. It's our ability to make the center province link work this year and next year and better the year after. It is those kind of roles where we facilitate and we troubleshoot and we remove the stumbling blocks, I think, that really do bring the key. It is far less that we are stepping in and substituting for the Iraqis. And I think we're still working on a mind meld on that point. We work far more by indirection, by helping figure out what is the catalyst here that would allow this to work right in this environment. So yeah, I do think we are bringing something really important here in terms of taking advantage of the lull in violence that we expect to come through this surge where we clear and hold, and now we actually also rekindle hope and we rekindle citizens' confidence that their government offers them a life that they're going to want to live. Mike, gosh, how many times have we had this conversation? And I am so with you. It is so frustrating to once again be back at this point where, you know, how come we don't have 10,000 civilians that we can deploy next week to do this? You have to keep going from the top. We're not doing an effective job presenting this to Congress. I think there is still such a misunderstanding. It continues, I believe, to be cast as lack of volunteerism, lack of patriotism on the part of the civilians. I think the civilians, we and the State Department, do not talk in capacity terms. I mean, think about it. You would never have DOD go on the Hill and not lay out what capacity you needed in order to do the mission. But we really are kind of policy people. And the idea that you can't just beat your State Department officers and make them work 26 hours a day in order to get it out of them is alien to our culture. It feels like weakness to say, actually, we really can't get three people to do the job of 1,000. I do believe it is incumbent upon us to learn from the military about talking about if you 15 years from now are going to need an FS1, you better hire them. And you need to start thinking about force flow, and we need to start training diplomats to think and speak in those terms when we go to our committees. I do think, Mike, that we do need police, we do need city managers, we do need agronomists. I'm not in despair about turning to the contractor community for this. I believe that an awful lot of the expertise that was once in AID when they had 15,000 people is now in the contractor community performing this service as implementers. Where I think we need to really focus our efforts on is making sure we're not contracting out the management structure. We need to have, you know, like that core team we're talking about that goes out, assesses it, says what's the strategy, and then when the specialist comes, says, this is the direction your government wants you to go, this is how we will know you have succeeded, rather than, I think we have not had that kind of management oversight. Certainly anyone who is a regular reader of the Special Inspector General for Iraq, his quarterly reports would agree that oversight has not been our strongest suit. I think we need to focus on that, but then you don't need thousands, which puts Congress off. You need a smaller cadre of across the major stakeholder agencies, state, DOD, justice, I think, as well. I think we need a conflict stream where state officers who are going to work this do a tour with a combatant command, do a tour with like Office of Transition Initiatives and Aid, and that we actually are rewarded for being in a conflict stream. Because currently the bureaucratic incentives do not reward people who move from El Salvador to South Africa to the Balkans to Northern Ireland to Iraq. You end up without a home base and you end up with your career actually weakened by having gone there. We actually need to create bureaucratic incentives for us to do this interagency component and to become that cadre, but then to go up with a unified voice and say you actually are going to have to beef up the ability to have people who you can send out to oversee these missions.
Bob, you had a comment?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the question of are PRTs the right answer? And I think the answer to that question is we don't really know. You know, is there an alternative way to organize ourselves? Could we get better results if we do something in a different way than one of the three models or four models or five or six or ten models now that we have for PRTs? If you look at the ISAF PRTs in Afghanistan, there may be 10 or 12 countries that are now engaged. Each one of them approaches the PRT concept in a different way with a different configuration of force structure and civilian components. And so we have a broad cross-section here of what PRTs might be or can be. Equally, we really have no metrics for measuring success because one of the things that we usually don't have is some sort of an agreed set of goals and objectives. And so while this is something of a tautology, it's also the fact that if you really don't know where you're going, sometimes you don't know when you're there. I had a conversation in Afghanistan with a general officer who says, well, we look at the province, and if the province is doing well, then we think, well, the PRT must be responsible.
I disagree and I agree. I think from my perspective, you know, I absolutely believe that the PRTs are an effective tool for countering an insurgency. You can call them whatever you want. You can staff them whatever you come up with. But the people have to see their government working for them. And so in order to do that, you know, the PRTs are a tool in order to enable, you know, the central government, the provincial government to be seen by their people. And so with that in mind, I think that is one of the strengths that concept or construct, whatever you want to call it, doesn't really matter from my perspective, is it's got to be out and working and seen by the people.
Can I add one comment
Certainly.
To that? It may be hard to determine whether the PRT is responsible for the success of the province, but I will say if there's one thing our people in the field are convinced of is where we are absent, the bad guys take over, and we lose any ability to shape this in the right direction.
Well, this has been an engaging and an enlightening conversation. The idea of a PRT as a tool for counterinsurgency operations, I think, is one that bears study, especially when you consider that insurgencies are all about legitimacy and who is perceived by the local population as the legitimate authority, however you define legitimacy. So I'd like to thank Barbara and Linda and Bob for your comments. Let's show our appreciation.